Why do you dream? And I don't mean like goals in life. I mean, why do you have dreams? You say, I don't really know. Well, if you talk to a doctor, guess what? They don't really know either. You look at all the medical research and the studies that have been done, they have pretty good theories about why people dream and the types of dreams they have and why you have a type of dream that you have on a particular day and all that. And they put all the data together and they think they know or they can come to a pretty solid conclusion, but still they say it's not an exact science, so to speak. It doesn't. 1 + 1 = 2 when it comes to dreams. It's just a very unusual field of study in the medical profession. There are a lot of theories, of course, about why we dream. Some say it's our unconscious desires that we present ourselves in the world in a way that's acceptable. But we go to sleep and we're asleep. The unconscious desires. We have suppressed urges. We process emotions. Some people say if dreams are just about emotions that you don't, again, use in life, that you don't express. You keep up a guard when you're around people. You go to sleep and you can express all those emotions fully that you wouldn't in society. Some look at it just simply based on how your day has been, the things that you've eaten, if you're sick, if you're healthy. What you ate right before you went to sleep and all those kinds of things, those theories about diet and lifestyle. They study dreams. They did a sleep study that wake people up right before they get into that deep REM stage of sleep. That's when you dream. It's in the deepest part of your sleeping. And they wake people up right before they got to that point, and they would let them fall back to sleep. They wouldn't let them get to that deep part, so they wouldn't have the dreams. And they said those people had anxiety, and they had depression, and they had weight gain and weight loss and all that sort of thing, which then they concluded, well, that might not be because they didn't dream, maybe because we kept waking them up. They just didn't get a good night's sleep. May not be about dreaming, just maybe we didn't let them get a full night's sleep, and maybe if you just get a full night's sleep, you're a lot healthier. I think we could all agree with that. People have recurring dreams. You probably have recurring dreams. Maybe a dream that you've had over and over again for years. You don't know when you're going to have it, but you have it. Dreams are strange. They're weird. There's a lot to be studied there, a lot to be discussed about dreams. If you read your Bibles, of course, you know that there's a lot of dreams in the Bible, dreams and visions. Sometimes we don't know if the Bible's talking about a vision like someone's awake and they have a vision, or if they're having a vision while they're asleep. But they're all throughout the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. As a matter of fact, God used dreams and visions to communicate messages to people. Abraham, Genesis 15, he got a dream, he got a vision, and that he was going to have a son, and he would be the father of many nations. God had repeated that to him. Jacob had that famous dream about the ladder, the angels going up and down the ladder, where God had told him, look, that promise to Abraham, guess what? It's going to go through to you too, and your name is going to be Israel. And that Messiah one day will come through your line of people. We know that Joseph, of course, probably the most famous for his dreams. And his dreams got him in trouble a couple of times. He had the dreams about his interpreted as his brothers bowing down to him one day, about the stars and about the fields and how all those things were bowing down to the one. He said, this is going to happen one day. His brothers didn't like that because they didn't want to bow down to him, and he was the favored child, and so they wanted to kill him. And they stopped doing that and decided to sell him instead, keep him alive. And then Joseph went to Egypt, and he interprets more dreams of Pharaoh and others. So there was a lot of dreaming in Joseph's life. But Samuel had dreams. He had a vision from God about what Eli's sons would do. And he was just a very young child at the time. Solomon was approached by God in a dream. And God says, what do you want? And he said, well, if I'm going to be the king, what I want is wisdom. Because he asked for that, he was given wisdom and he was given incredible wealth by God as well. We know in the New Testament, Zacharias was given a dream, said you're going to have a son named John the Baptist, or would be John, rather, known as John the Baptist. We know Joseph, Jesus' father, earthly father, had actually three visions, three dreams. One is, don't get rid of Mary. Another was, you got to flee down to Egypt because Herod's killing all the babies. And then he had another one that said, okay, now you can go back. You can go back home because Herod's dead and you're safe. There are a lot of dreams in the Bible. A lot of prominent people got messages from the Lord about what to do. But those weren't the only types of dreams in the Bible. They weren't just from God. They weren't messages about how to advance the gospel or about the coming of Jesus and all those types of things. Some of them didn't have that kind of spiritual significance. I want you to turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 27. Now let's talk about a dream that we read about in Matthew 27 that we kind of ignore. I could listen to other visions and other dreams people had in the Bible, and you would recognize them. If I mentioned this one, you'd say, well, I forgot about that one. And maybe you didn't even notice it at all. Maybe when we talk about it today, you'll say, well, I didn't even realize that was there. I forgot that was part of the story. We have in Matthew chapter 27 when Jesus approaches Pilate, the governor. Some called him in the ancient world. His title was a prefect. Prefect or governor of Judea. From about the year 26 to about the year 36. So Jesus, of course, is going to begin his ministry when he's about 30 years old. So that would put him in the early 30s, the year. So basically throughout Jesus' life, most of his life, Pilate is the governor of Judea, the southern part of Palestine. And you say, well, I know about Judah. What's Judea? Same thing. Judea is just a Roman term for it. Judah is more the Hebrew term. Romans called it Judea. That's why you read Judea in the New Testament. So Pilate is the Roman governor of this area of Judea, of course. And the Jews are allowed to live their lives in Judea. The Romans accommodated them. The Romans said, you can live your life. You can have your Sanhedrin. You can have your temple. Herod even rebuilt it for them. Herod's temple, the one Jesus used, was designed and built by Herod, the great architect that we studied a few weeks ago in the series on Israel. Herod was one of the worst people that ever lived. He was one of the most awful people that ever walked the earth, but he could build anything. And so his temple was the one Jesus used, again, accommodating the Jews, letting them live their lives, but of course they had to pay tax to Rome. And still, the ultimate authority was Rome. And Pilate is the governor of this part of Palestine. But the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, the Jewish authority, brings Jesus to Pilate in Matthew 27. And in the book of Luke, and in Luke's account of this, Luke says that they brought him to Pilate with two accusations. They said, one thing is, he calls himself a king. And the other one is that he won't pay his taxes. That he won't render unto Caesar. What is Caesar? Now again, they think this is going to really make a difference to Pilate because there are only two rules for the Jews that lived under Roman authority. Romans really only told them to do two things. Don't rebel. Pay your taxes. You do that, you do those things, and we'll all live together just fine. But don't ever rise up against Rome. And if we tell you to pay 80% tax, you pay it. If we tell you to pay 5% tax, you pay it. So the Sanhedrin, they're pretty smart. They bring Jesus to Pilate and say, guess what? Jesus violated two biggest rules. Jesus says he's a king, and you don't like that, do you? You don't want us to have kings. You don't want us to have another King David. He's going to have an army. You don't like that, do you? You don't want us to rebel. You don't want us, the Jewish people, to rise up against Rome. He says he's a king. Not only that, he's going around telling people not to pay taxes. And I know you don't like that either. After all, what did he do? He calls Matthew to be an apostle. He got a tax collector to quit his job. They don't mention that in Luke, but think about what Jesus did in his life. How about Zacchaeus, tax collector? All of a sudden, he converts Zacchaeus. Goes, stays in his house. Zacchaeus says, I've been cheating people. He said, I'm going to figure out how much I have, and I'm going to give back four times as much because I've been cheating people. So you go throughout Jesus' life, and Sanhedrin put some of those things together as evidence that I will see. He's trying to throw a wrench, so to speak, in the tax system. He's trying to convert all the tax collectors. So they thought, oh, Pilate's really going to be mad about this. He'll throw him in prison, he'll crucify him, this is going to be easy. Because Jesus is going to rebel, and Jesus is going to say, you don't have to pay tax. Well, that's not really what happened. They bring Jesus to Pilate. Pilate said, I don't know what's wrong with him. Pilate says, are you a king? He said, yeah. Jesus said, it is as you say, depending on which part of the Gospels and which version you have, something along those lines. But that really didn't even stir up anything with Pilate, because Jesus wasn't an unpopular person. Pilate still didn't find any intimidation here. He didn't really sound like a king, even though he said, yeah, that's what you said is right. I'm sure Pilate looked at him and said, well, you don't sound like one. You don't act like one. I don't have a problem with this guy. I don't see what the problem is. And so he says, it's the Passover. And so again, to accommodate the Jews, to appease the Jews, the Romans every year of the Passover said, I'll release one of your people. We'll have a release of a prisoner. Did it every year. I said, okay, look, everybody calm down. I give you Barabbas. One of the Gospels says Barabbas was a murderer, a convicted murderer. And the people said, no, we don't want him. No, give us him, crucify Jesus. We want him crucified. And he kept saying, I don't find any guilt in him. And he does the famous thing that we still use the phrase today about washing hands. Pilate goes over and he puts his hands in water, he washes his hands and said, I'm innocent of this man's blood. And he allows for the execution to happen. But he always wants to say, look, I'm just going to let this happen. You're so fired up. A riot is about to happen. I'll let you have him. I'll let him be crucified. But keep in mind, I'm kind of neutral on this. But I want us to notice, you mentioned something about a dream. You were talking about dreams earlier. Where's the dream in here? Look at verse 19. In the middle of this discussion, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him a message saying, have nothing to do with that righteous man. For last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. The chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death. But the governor said to them, which of the two do you want me to release for you? And they said, Barabbas. Pilate's wife comes to him and said, I had a dream about Jesus. I had a dream about Jesus. How many times have you had a dream about Jesus? Probably not. Probably not that often. May have, I don't know. She has a dream about Jesus and she calls him the righteous one. But even though she calls him the righteous one, she says, have nothing to do with him. Because in this dream I suffered because of him. this Jesus person caused me some problems. I didn't sleep well because of this person, because of Jesus and having this dream about him. It was greatly troubling. I would assume, just an assumption, that she had never met Jesus. I would assume that Jesus had never harmed her, and that we can be pretty confident about. Jesus had never done anything to her that was negative. Probably never met each other. And she said, I had a dream about him, this righteous one, and you need to let him alone. You need to get out of this situation, Pilate. I don't feel good about it. Has Jesus ever troubled you? You say, how could Jesus trouble anybody? Well, he troubled Pilate's wife. Has Jesus ever bothered you? You've never met Jesus in terms of shaking his hand. You've never put your arm around him to hug him. You've been in that situation too. Jesus has never hurt you in any way. But has Jesus ever troubled you like he troubled Pilate's wife? You say, well, I don't think so, but I would assume he has. If you've ever read the Bible, if you ever read what Jesus preached, he's probably troubled you. Matter of fact, if you look at all the aspects of Jesus' ministry, it presents quite a bit of trouble. Jesus isn't easy to deal with because you see him and then you see yourself. And that disturbs you. Pilate's wife was not the first person to be troubled by Jesus, and she's definitely not the last person. We know Jesus, of course, is a historical figure. Listen to what Napoleon said about Jesus, the great French general, early 1800s. Listen to this. But can you conceive of a dead man making conquests with an army faithful and entirely devoted to his memory? My armies have forgotten me, even while living, as the Carthaginian army forgot Hannibal. Such is our power. A single battle lost crushes us, and adversity scatters our friends. Can you conceive of Caesar as the eternal emperor of the Roman Senate, and from the depths of his mausoleum governing the empire, watching over the destinies of Rome? Such is the history of the world by the invasion of Christianity. Such is the power of the God of the Christians. Nations pass away, thrones crumble, but the church remains. Christ speaks, and at once generations become his by stricter, closer ties than those of blood. He lights up the flames of a love which condemns self-love, which prevails over every other love. Napoleon said, I can't even understand how vast and how significant the reign of Christ is. One of the most powerful men that's ever lived said, I lose a battle, they'll forget about me. They won't do anything else I ever say. He said, can you imagine Caesar still having control over Rome after he dies? Of course not. Somebody else rises up, the laws change, culture changes, people move on. He said, Jesus says things, and that unites people closer together than relatives, than blood. He said, I can't imagine. I don't understand. So that troubles people. That's a challenge for people to realize the influence and the power of Jesus, even though he died 2,000 years ago. What about Jesus as a teacher? Not just a person, a historical figure, but what about Jesus as a teacher? This is the part that really troubles people. Notice how Jesus taught people. He didn't just use one method. Sometimes he just was in conversation with people, talking to the woman at the well. One woman, by herself, Jesus sits down and talks to her. Essentially preaches to her, takes her right where she is in the life that she's living, knows all about her life, and talks to her about how people are going to worship, talks to her about her husbands. And this woman went away absolutely amazed at the fact that Jesus knew all about her and they had never met. You have the Sermon on the Mount. That would challenge you every day of your life if you read it every day of your life. Verse after verse, just when you think that you have reached some moral platitude, you've reached some height of morality, and all of a sudden you read the Sermon on the Mount and you think, I'm not anywhere close to what I need to be. How he talked about cities, at times getting, we assume, to be very angry about cities like Bethsaida and Chorazin that I've shown you pictures of. He said, I've done all these miracles around here and you refuse to be. And woe to you who refuse to believe even after I've done all these things. So at times he was very pointed in his sermons. At times he was very soft. At times he didn't say much at all. At times he would tell a lesson and say, hey, don't tell anybody, we just talked about this. Jesus troubled a lot of people with how he taught and how he preached. Again, the moral code that he presented was so different than the moral code of his day and our day. When Jesus talks about adultery, when he talks about our minds and our hearts, in the world that he lived in, where you had pagan temples where the priests or priestesses were prostitutes, and to go to a prostitute was almost a form of worship to those gods. Imagine saying the things Jesus was saying in that setting. You think our world is immoral. You think we allow things we shouldn't allow. Jesus' day was as worse or much worse. Imagine how challenging those lessons were. And then we have somebody troubling the life of people by performing miracles that nobody denied. Nobody denied that happened. And verifying the fact he's the Son of God. The life of Jesus challenged Napoleon. It challenged the people who heard those sermons in Jesus' day. Jesus' life was challenging on the moral level. It was challenging the fact that he said he was the Son of God and proved it. And then we're left, of course, with all the responses to that. How do you respond to Jesus and how he's influenced the world like no one else ever has? How do you respond to Jesus and what he taught about morality? How do you respond to Jesus as a teacher, as the Son of God? In this passage in Matthew 27, you kind of get all of the responses of people, how people respond to Jesus today. Here's Jesus basically being stood up in front of powerful people. He's on display. And all the crowd and the Romans and everybody is making a judgment of Jesus. Think about it. He's not saying hardly anything. He doesn't have an attorney present. There's no due process and all the rights we have as Americans when we're accused of something. He's just standing there and everybody is making their case, deciding what they believe about Jesus. So here you have all types of responses. First of all, you've got the mob. And they're saying, crucify him. Crucify him. Kill him. Get him out of my life altogether. We are tired of him. He is upset our world so much that we would just rather him die than deal with it. Somebody made a great statement once about this passage, saying the world will always choose Barabbas. The world will always choose Barabbas. They'll always choose the worst person. They'll always choose the one that lowers the standard, that's more permissive, that allows people to live selfishly. Given the choice of murderer and Jesus, people said, no, we choose Barabbas. Somebody said, ever since then, people have always been doing that. I'd rather have him. I'd rather have the lesser. Instead of raising the standard, instead of living life the perfect one, trying to strive to serve him, we'd rather just be with the common, the worldly. The mob says kill him. People are trying to kill Jesus today all the time. People are still trying to get Jesus out of culture, get Jesus out of the way. I don't want to hear about him. I don't want to deal with him. Stop talking about him. Get him out. It's not any different than the mob who was looking at Jesus that day. So the mob says kill him. That's one response to Jesus. We see it all the time. Even now. We also see a lot of what Pilate was doing, because Pilate said, I'm going to be neutral. If there's a way that I can still sort of live my life the way I want to live it and still say that Jesus is a good old guy, I'll do that. Pilate is doing everything in the world to be neutral, to be in the middle. So I can't find guilt in him. I'm innocent of this man's blood. I'm going to wash my hands of this person. If you kill him, that's not on me, so to speak. Don't come to me. It'll be on you. But whatever you do with him is okay with me. A lot of people today acting like Pilate. I'll say the nice things about Jesus. I'll say, yeah, he's innocent. Yeah, Jesus was perfect. I'll say a lot of good things about Jesus, but in the end, if Jesus isn't in my life, then I don't care. If Jesus has run out of society, if Jesus isn't in part of people's lives anymore, I don't really care. I'm going to be neutral. I'll do what I want to do, and I'll give or take Jesus. Right after this passage, beginning of verse 27, you have the soldiers, their response. The mob says kill him. Pilate says, I want to be neutral. The soldiers mock him. They strip him down. They put the crown of thorns on him. They mock him as king of the Jews. We got a lot of people doing that today. That's the response to Jesus. Because he shakes up their life. They're troubled by him. Not maybe in a dream like Pilate's wife, but they're still troubled by the life of Christ. So they just make fun of him. You know, children do that. On the playground, the school. Children, if somebody's more athletic, somebody's more popular, somebody has something they don't have, sometimes their defense is, well, we'll just kind of lower that person by making fun of them. I don't know how to deal with them any other way. I'm not on their level, so I'll try to bring them down and mock them, humiliate them, feel a little bit better about myself. Same thing they did with Jesus here. The soldiers watch this. We'll mock him. We'll put a little, how about this crown? You say you're a king, we'll put a crown of thorns on you. We'll see what kind of king you're going to be with a crown of thorns. We'll beat you within an inch of your life. Hey, if you're so strong and you say you're so powerful and you've done all these things, well then stop us. People do that today with Jesus. They just make fun of him. They just mock his people. Make fun of what they do, what they say, how they live their lives. They mock the Bible. It's a fantasy. It's no different than any fictional book that you could buy. So on and so forth. A lot of people are like those soldiers who just mocked Jesus. A lot of people are like the Sanhedrin who brought Jesus to Pilate. They bring him to Pilate and they bring these accusations of, hey, he's a king, he's a rebel, by saying that. Oh, he's trying to get people to stop paying their taxes. Is that what really happened? No. Did Jesus not say when he was asked about paying taxes, we have to do this? And he just took the coin and said, well, my name's not on it. It looks like Caesar's name's on it, so I guess you got to give him what is his. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give God what's God. Never once did Jesus ever say, stop paying taxes, rebel against the government. You make your own laws. He never said that. The Sanhedrin, though, presented Jesus as if that's what he was doing. A lot of people treat Jesus that way, false witness. That's what the Sanhedrin is doing. Let's take a few things I can gather over here, and let's make a story that sounds good, but really isn't the truth. Let's just kind of mix things together and come up with a way that we can get it. People do that with the Bible today. They do that with the words of Jesus. They'll see something that Jesus taught and say, well, that's what Jesus said, but I'm going to kind of mix it with what I think, and lo and behold, look, Jesus approves of what I do. Isn't it interesting where always the interpretation leads the person to do exactly what they want to do, the way they want to do it? That's like the Sanhedrin of Jesus, of what we're reading here. They take a little bit of what Jesus did and make an accusation out of it when it's not even true to begin with. Some people are like the mob. Get rid of Jesus. Just kill him. I want to hear about it. I want to see him. Some people today are like Pilate. Want to be neutral. Some are like the soldiers. Just make fun of him. Some are like the Sanhedrin. Just false witness. Make false accusations about him. And then later on, of course, we have more famous judgments or attitudes toward Jesus by some of his close associates. Well, we have Peter, who's with him for 3.5 years. And when Jesus wasn't around anymore for him to stand beside, and when the crowd was loud, and when accusations were being made, and the heat got turned up, Peter was asked, do you know him? He said, no. I don't know who you're talking about. Denies him again, and the third time, and depending on your translation, and it says that he cursed. He got so mad he used bad language of their day, whatever that may be. He said, I really don't know him. And that's another attitude people have about Jesus. Jesus, I'm a loyal, faithful person. But if the heat gets turned up, if the people that I'm standing around don't like him, well, then I don't know who he is. I don't know who you're talking about. Aren't you that person that goes to church over at Pleasant View? Aren't you that person that goes to church wherever? Sometimes, maybe. Yeah, well, what are y'all doing this week? Hey, yeah, I want to go with you. I'm not real faithful. I'll do whatever y'all want to do that may keep me away from church, from worship services, Bible studies, or whatever activity hurts other aspects of my faith. Are you like Peter? Like Judas, who just betrays Jesus? With him until the end, it says, for the right amount of money, I'll do whatever you want me to do to Jesus. Probably the most extreme view that somebody can have of Jesus, being loyal, and then at the end, not just denying him, not just being neutral, but actually trying to harm him and go against the cause of Christ. Pilate's wife was not the first person to ever be troubled by Jesus. She wasn't the first, she's not going to be the last. Because even though Jesus had never sinned, even though Jesus never hurt a soul, he's challenging. He troubles people because they're not him. And the only thing to do with Jesus to save your souls to be faithful, to obey him, not fight him. Pilate's wife said, oh, get away from him. You got to get away from him. That's not the answer. We're troubled by Jesus in really the good way. We're troubled by Jesus, and by being faithful, we improve our life. We submit to him. We do what he says, particularly as it relates to salvation. Never given your life to Christ, you need to do that today. Stop fighting. Stop coming up with reasons not to obey. I'm saying something, you know, this part about obeying the gospel troubles me. This part about what the Bible says to follow him, you know, that troubles me. And I'm going to argue it. I'm going to get away from it. We need to stop doing that. And just simply say, I believe Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I'm going to turn away from my sins. And I'm going to obey him. I want to become a Christian. I want to be baptized into Christ. If that's what you need to do today, or you just need prayers, we can assist you. Please come while we stand and sing.